Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
That's right. Welcome back to the History of Being Human podcast. The most heroic sounding podcast in the entire world. At least this slightly melodramatic intro music. Pretty majestic stuff, thanks to Tartalo Music, T-A-R-T-A-L-O Music. The Crusader, it's called. Because today on the History of Being Human podcast, we're going to continue our series on the Inquisition, this time speaking about a matter that is related, even if only in a tangential way, to the Inquisition. Today I'm going to present an overview of the history of the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar, let me just say right at the outset, were an actual thing. They really did exist. Why is it even necessary to say that at the outset? Because their entire history and existence is shrouded in conspiracy theories, mythological quests, holy grails, pieces of the true cross, mystical knowledge, magical powers, tales of secret initiations, demon worship, hermetic codes, alchemy, or secrets of the ancient mariners that allowed them to supposedly circumnavigate the entire globe long before 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So many mythological and conspiracy-based and occult theories surround the Knights Templar, possibly more than any other group on Earth, except maybe the Illuminati. And there's a relevant passage to this in the novel Foucault's Pendulum by Umberto Eco from the late 80s. And in that book, Eco, may he rest in peace, presents a conversation between two characters arguing, of course tongue-in-cheek, about the difference between a moron and a lunatic. One of the arguing characters says this, quote, "The moron proves his thesis. The moron has logic, however twisted it may be. The lunatic, on the other hand, doesn't concern himself at all with logic. He works by short circuits. For him, everything proves everything else. The lunatic is obsessed, and whatever he comes across confirms his lunacy. You can tell the lunatic by the liberties he takes with common sense, by his flashes of inspiration, and the fact that sooner or later he brings up the Templars. There are lunatics who don't bring up the Templars, but those who do are the most insidious." End quote. And I owe that quote to a lecture given on the subject by the historian Kevin Mayne. So at the risk of identifying myself as a lunatic, I'm going to bring up the Templars today on this episode. The Templars make for great stories, great fiction. It's a Knight Templar in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade that tells Indy he must choose the goblet that is the real Holy Grail or risk certain death. The Templars also figure into the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, but they're controlled by a dark and formidable inner secret society called the Priory of Zion, a society which, unfortunately, there is not one shred of evidence that they ever did exist. But the Templars did, and it's not just recently that these kinds of fringe associations have been made with the Knights Templar. In fact, as early as the 1200s, there was an epic poem which was very popular, tens of thousands of lines long, called Parzival, written by Wolfram von Eschenbach. And the Knights Templar figure into that epic poem in a slightly altered form. In that poem, Parzival, the title character, is a young knight who is seeking out the Holy Grail. So he finds the wise hermit Trevresant, who tells him how to find the Grail. Trevresant says, quote, "At Mont Sauvage live a knightly brotherhood who are called Templars, and they serve there or in the world as the Grail commands." End quote. Parzival asks the hermit, "How are these knights sustained? What keeps them going?" And the hermit replies, quote, "It is a stone pure and precious. Through its magic, the wondrous bird, the phoenix, rises from the ashes to new life. Also is man renewed by it. If he be ill and look upon it, he is made well. Those who look upon it daily never grow old. This stone is called the Grail." End quote. So literary tales, probably based on rumors, of the Knights Templar being in possession of the Holy Grail go all the way back to the first decades of their existence. From their very beginning, it seems, the Templars had, and continue to have, a hold on the imagination of the West. In fact, groups of Knights Templar continue to this very day. In fact, you can go to KnightsTemplar.org and look at the webpage of a group you can actually join. A group that no longer fights in medieval battles, but claims to be the spiritual descendants of the Knights Templar. From their webpage, you read the following information, quote, "From humble beginnings, the Knights Templar rose to become the most powerful military monastic order of the medieval world. Pledged to protect pilgrims during the Crusades, the Templars became heroes to Christians everywhere. Their fighting prowess was legendary. The sight of their white cloaks and red crosses inspired the faithful and struck terror into their enemies. Young men rushed to join the order, taking vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to fight for God. By the 13th century, the order commanded thousands of men, ships, and castles in every country in Europe. Considered untouchable, the Templars owed allegiance to no king, only to the Pope himself." End quote. That statement, even with its propagandist bent, is essentially true. This was the state of the Knights Templar at their height of influence, wealth, and power. They really did exist, and there is a core of historical truth within all the mythology that surrounds them. We will take a peek into what can actually be known about the history of a secret society of the High Middle Ages, formerly known as the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and the Temple of Solomon, but more commonly known as the Knights Templar, from their humble beginnings to their successes in battle, to the heights of power and wealth, to their ruthless, brutal suppression at the hands of the Inquisition and European monarchies. The story of the Knights Templar is simple if you tell it in a broad overview. They were formed during the Crusades to protect Christians going to Jerusalem on pilgrimage. They also fought in several skirmishes. They grew in wealth and power and influence. They were granted a charter by the Pope that gave them great freedom. They didn't have to report to kings, didn't have to pay taxes, answered only to the Pope himself. They could move anywhere they wanted throughout Christian Europe. They built several important fortresses and churches, made a lot of money, developed a banking system, which was quite ahead of its time. But as the Crusaders began to lose control over the Holy Land, and as threats from Mongols became much more worrisome to Christian Europe than the Muslims, the Knights Templar lost patronage, power, support. They remained a little bit more rich than they were powerful, which is always a very dangerous place to be. And Philip IV, the indebted French king, decided to persecute the order to cancel his debts to them, and he hoped confiscate their wealth for himself. Other European monarchs soon got the spirit, followed suit, and the Knights Templar were effectively eradicated as an order. A pretty simple story occupying less than 200 years from its very beginning to its very end during the High Middle Ages. And really, if you know that, you know about 80% of all there is that's relevant about the Knights Templar. But the details of their story are kind of fascinating because they overlap, they interweave with so much that was going on in Europe and the Holy Land during the Middle Ages. And as I already alluded to, the Inquisition gets involved. And these self-proclaimed humble followers of Christ, who swear poverty, chastity, and obedience and devote their lives, give their lives in many cases to defend Christians, become kindling for the Inquisition as it capitulates in the most cravenly and cowardly fashion to the whims of a corrupt king. And yes, I do realize that I just committed the sin, the great sin of alliteration. So before I get into more bad prose, let's begin at the beginning. Let's begin with the Crusades themselves. In a previous episode, I talked about the People's Crusade. And in that, we talked about the fact that the Seljuk Turks were encroaching on the Byzantine Empire and the Emperor Alexius I Komnenos in the last part of the 11th century. In 1095, Alexius I Komnenos sends a plea for help to Pope Urban II. Not only does Urban apparently want to help the pilgrims who are going to the Holy Land, but it's also an opportunity to mend what's called the Great Schism, the Great Schism of 1054. You can remember that date in history. The Great Schism of 1054. This was an event that the church was still reeling from some 41 years later when Alexius Komnenos appealed to Pope Urban II for help. Now, just a word on why the Great Schism of 1054 had occurred. For years, there had been mounting tension between Eastern and Western branches of the church. The church in the East, based in Constantinople, believed that a council of bishops should decide all ecclesiastical matters. While the Western church, under the Pope, which is the Bishop of Rome, disagreed. They thought the Pope should have the final say in all these matters. And it was important because there were many points of disagreement between East and West. In the Eastern churches, the Mass was said in Greek. In the West, it was said in Latin. Another controversy. The Eastern churches were iconoclastic. They considered the use of religious icons as heretical or idolatrous. In the West, they supported the use of religious iconography. But believe it or not, the biggest controversies came over points of doctrine, and pretty abstruse pieces of doctrine at that. In fact, the final nail in the coffin of the unity of the Eastern and Western churches was what's called the Filioque controversy. These churches divided primarily over the question of, get this, whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father alone, or whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. The Eastern Orthodox, or Greek churches as they're commonly called, all believed it proceeded from the Father alone. The Roman Church, under the Pope, believed that it proceeded from the Father and the Son. This controversy was so heated that the Eastern Church excommunicated the Western Church as heretics, and the Western Church excommunicated the Eastern Church. And from that time forward, the Eastern Church was led by the Patriarch of Constantinople, and the Western Church was led by the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, in other words. So when Alexius Komnenos reached out to Pope Urban, it's natural for Urban, just 41 years after the Great Schism had taken place, to see this as a potential opportunity to mend some fences. And that's what led to, as we said, in 1096 at the Council of Clermont, Pope Urban II ramps up the rhetoric, talks about the suffering of the Christians in the Holy Land, graphically portrays a series of outrages perpetrated against these humble followers of Christ. He recommends that people take up an armed pilgrimage to the Holy Land to cast the infidel out of Jerusalem. And he promises absolution, forgiveness of sins to any who die along the way. And as we know, that sends off waves of pilgrims, armed pilgrims, to try to free Jerusalem from the infidel, as they called it. The first wave was what's called the People's Crusade under Peter the Hermit. And they, of course, fail miserably. That's followed close after by the second wave of the First Crusade, also known as the Prince's Crusade, in which the nobility, the aristocracy of France, make their way through Anatolia, fighting as they go, enduring starvation and privations of all kinds, until they were eventually successful and decisively victorious at the sieges of Antioch in 1097 and 1098, and the siege of Jerusalem, which ended in July of 1099, with the Crusader armies successfully capturing Jerusalem and massacring all of its defenders. So before the turn of the 12th century, the Christian Crusaders have captured Jerusalem. They then proceed to set up four Crusader states. If you look at a map of the Crusader states, you'll see that along with the Kingdom of Jerusalem, there is what's called the County of Edessa, the Principality of Antioch, and the County of Tripoli. So the big picture is that these Crusader states were Western Europeans under the control of the Roman Pope, not under the Byzantine Emperor, occupying the entire coast of the Levant between about 1100 almost to 1300. About 1291 is when they fell. And this is where the story of the Knights Templar begins, because after the Crusaders captured Jerusalem and established these Crusader states, as you might imagine, there was an influx of pilgrims. Everybody wanted to go to the Holy Land to see Jerusalem. Now, the city of Jerusalem itself was pretty well defended. It was pretty safe for the pilgrims, but getting there was not. The rest of the Crusader states were very, very dangerous. If you landed on the coast, say at Jaffa, you had to make the journey inland to Jerusalem. You were very likely to be robbed and probably slaughtered. If you tried to make the journey over land, your odds were not much better. So this was a problem for the Crusader states. Now, about 20 years after the fall of Jerusalem, in 1119, a French knight, a man named Hugues du Payens, spelled H-U-G-U-E-S-D-E-P-A-Y-E-N-S, if you want to look him up. But this Hugues du Payens approached King Baldwin II of Jerusalem for the purpose of creating a new monastic order. not a monastic order devoted to preaching the word or contemplation or prayer or even brewing fine ale as other monastic orders had done. This would be a monastic order of fighting men, knights devoted to protecting pilgrims to the Holy Land. Well, King Baldwin agrees to this request, and he formalizes that agreement at the Council of Nablus in January of 1120. King Baldwin gives this new monastic order a very prestigious location for their headquarters. When the Crusader armies captured Jerusalem, they captured the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they believed that when they captured this mosque, they were capturing the ruins of the Temple of Solomon. Not that they were right about that, but it was so commonly thought to be the Temple of Solomon that that's just what they called it. So when this new monastic order, devoted to protecting pilgrims in the Holy Land, was given a wing in the prestigious palace of King Baldwin, the very structure that they thought was the ruins of the Temple of Solomon, they decided to incorporate that into their name. They called themselves the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. Shortened, this was the Knights Templar. According to the histories written about them, they were pretty humble in the beginning. For the first several years, they didn't have many followers, not many people joining the order, and not many resources. According to a chronicle written in 1163, so a few decades later, by William of Tyre, quote, "Although the knights now had been established for 9 years, there were still only 9 of them. From this time onward, their numbers began to grow and their possessions began to multiply. Later, it is said that both the knights and their humbler servants, called sergeants, began to affix crosses made of red cloth to their mantles, so as to distinguish themselves from others," end quote. And the key point of that quote is just that there were only 9 of these Knights Templar for the first 9 years of their existence. And they had so few resources. Of course, they had to rely on the donations of others. But why would you donate to an order that doesn't really seem to be taking off? Because it was so humble, they didn't get many donations. The symbol that they chose for themselves was 2 knights riding on 1 horse. The symbol was to emphasize their poverty. They continued using this symbol even when the order itself became very wealthy, because the individual knights had sworn an oath of poverty. They could not enrich themselves, no matter how many donations flowed into the coffers. So in 1119, Uctapeon is given a charter to form this religious order. He forms it, and 9 years after it's formed, it still only has 9 members. And if something hadn't changed, the entire movement would have disappeared into obscurity. They could have come and gone, and you'd never have heard a word about them, like so many other groups that came and went. But what changed was they secured the patronage of a very influential person, Bernard of Clairvaux. That's right, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard was the founder of a very successful group of monks, a monastic order called the Cistercians, and he threw his weight behind the new Knights Templar order. Of course, it didn't hurt that one of the Knights Templar, one of the founding members of the group, was his uncle. But Bernard wrote a persuasive letter called In Praise of the New Knighthood, and in 1129 he went to the Council of Troyes and advocated the cause of the Knights Templar. I can't overemphasize how important the patronage of Bernard of Clairvaux was for the Knights Templar. Their beginning was anything but auspicious, and their first 9 years were anything but glorious. They started the order with 9 knights. By the end of 9 years, they had still exactly 9 knights. Almost no money. Very little patronage. In fact, about the only good thing that had happened to them was that King Baldwin had given them a wing in his palace in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the supposed site of the former Temple of Solomon. But since that time, back in 1120, not much had happened good for the knights. And their failure to catch on, to garner support, to get patronage, was causing some of even the original 9 to wonder what they were doing. And really, when you think about it, they're not wrong to wonder what they were doing. They are followers of the man who said, turn the other cheek and love your enemies, do good to those who hurt you, etc. And here they are taking up arms, fighting and killing people, which makes about as much sense as the Buddha beef factory or the Hasidic pork farm. So some of the knights were going through an existential crisis. In fact, just before Bernard of Clairvaux wrote his defense of the Knights Templar, an open letter was sent throughout Christendom addressed to the Knights Templar from a man who called himself Hugh the Sinner, Ugo Pegator, and he openly declared the idea of fighting monks absurd. So the period of the early founding of the Knights Templar was a time of soul-searching for some of the knights, wondering what they were doing there. Was there a future as fighting monks? And Bernard's letter and advocacy are so powerful. If you just read through it, even in a cursory fashion, you can't help but admire how powerful his prose was. He must have been a great speaker also. Bernard, in just a few pages, reinterprets, reinvents the Knights Templar into warriors not only of the flesh, but of the spirit. Spiritual crusaders, perfectly worthy of being called monks and knights at the same time. I'll read you just a couple of excerpts to give you an idea. He says, quote, "This is, I say, a new kind of knighthood, and one unknown to the ages gone by. It wages a twofold war, both against flesh and blood, and against a spiritual army of evil in the heavens. When someone strongly resists a foe in the flesh, relying solely on the strength of the flesh, I would hardly remark about it, since this is common enough. And when war is waged by spiritual strength against vices or demons, this too is nothing remarkable, praiseworthy as it is, for the world is full of monks. But when one sees a man powerfully girding himself with both swords and a monk's belt, who would not consider it worthy of all wonder, the more so since it has been hitherto unknown?" A little further on, he addresses any misgivings they might have about killing other people. He says, quote, "The Knight of Christ, I say, may strike with confidence and die yet more confidently, for he serves Christ when he strikes and serves himself when he falls. Neither does he bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of the good." And this next line, I think, is especially key, especially telling in rationalizing the violence that the Knights Templar perpetrated on their enemies. He says, quote, "If he kills an evildoer, he is not a man-killer, but, if I may so put it, a killer of evil." So, I love that line. When you kill somebody who's an evildoer, you're not killing a person, you're killing evil. Bernard goes on in this same vein. These were obviously very violent times. He says, "The Christian glories in the death of the pagan because Christ is glorified, while the death of a Christian gives occasion for the king to show his liberality in the rewarding of his knights." So you can see why Bernard's writing was so motivational to the Knights Templar order. They simply can't lose. If they win in battle, they're killing pagans to the greater glory of God. If they lose in battle, they are bringing glory to their own souls. We don't know exactly when Bernard wrote this letter, but we do know it was instrumental in changing the status of the Knights Templar. In 1129, after Bernard writes this letter, he goes to the Council of Troyes and argues for the full endorsement and approval of the Church of the Knights Templar order. And they are granted that. So after 1129, when they're granted official status, the official blessing of the Church is put upon the Knights Templar order, they become one of the favorite charities in all of Christendom. And you can see why. Monks being pious, practicing humility and love, that's appealing to some. But human beings are fascinated by violence. Pride and hate invigorate. And yet we always have some misgiving, feel a little bit of guilt about violence for violence's sake. So what really sells is pious violence, violence in a noble cause. And that goes for Liam Neeson and Dwayne Johnson just as much as it went for Hugues de Payen and the Knights Templar. Suddenly they were the pious freedom fighters of Christendom, and money, land, resources, patronage of all kinds came flowing in. And soon, they were a very wealthy order indeed, but they never forgot their humble roots. I think I said their symbol was two knights on one horse to remind them that they were a poor order in the beginning, and also that they took a vow of poverty. The knights could not enrich themselves with the money that was donated to their order. In fact, by all accounts, they led a very virtuous and disciplined lifestyle. Going back to the letter written by Bernard of Clairvaux on the new knighthood, he sets forth their lifestyle as exemplary among Christians. He says this, quote, "Let us see how they conduct themselves at home as well as in battle, how they appear in public, and in what way the knight of God differs from the knight of the world. In the first place, discipline is in no way lacking, and obedience is never despised. The knights come and go at the bidding of their superior. They wear what he gives them and do not presume to wear or eat anything from another source. Thus they shun every excess in clothing and food, and content themselves with what is necessary. They live as brothers in joyful and sober company, without wives or children. They dwell united in one family with no personal property whatsoever, careful to keep the unity of the spirit in the bond of peace." End quote. So this, at least, is the perception of how the Knights Templar lived. And by all accounts, we don't have a lot of exceptions to that rule. There really is no example of a Knight Templar going rogue trying to enrich himself, trying to take control of the order, stage a coup, anything like that. At least from the records we have, they were obviously still human, but they did seem to live very disciplined lives. And their status and reputation grew to the point that they were given special privileges by the Pope himself. Innocent III, in 1139, sends out a papal bull called Omne Datum Optimum. And listen to what the Knights Templar are granted. The first is, they are answerable to no authority whatsoever except the Pope's. No kings, no magistrates, no other rulers, just the Pope. No matter what country they're in, they are not beholden to local laws or local authorities. If any king or mayor or sheriff wanted to bring in a Knights Templar, they couldn't do it. They were answerable only to the Pope himself. And this also meant they could go wherever they wanted and did not have to observe international borders whatsoever. Throughout all Christendom, they ranged wherever they felt like. And what might have been the most upsetting provision to kings, queens, princes, etc., they didn't have to pay taxes to any secular authority. As the order became more and more wealthy, they owed no taxes, no matter what land they were in, to anyone except the Pope. We have to admit that this might have aroused the ire of some of the rulers, the regional rulers at the time, but they couldn't do anything about it. The Knights Templar were the darlings of Christian Europe, the Pope's own army, the shock troops leading crusaders into battle, protecting pilgrims in the Holy Land, striking terror into the hearts of the Saracens. And let's face it, they were fearless warriors. They were renowned for fighting to the death, refusing to surrender, even when all around them were fleeing from the battle. That was the kind of discipline they fought with. Again, according to Bernard of Clairvaux, quote, "A Templar knight is truly a fearless knight, and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel," end quote. And let's face it, with the resources at their disposal, with the noblemen that they attracted to their ranks, it's reasonable to expect the Knights Templar to be the best armed, the best trained, the most effective fighting force in Europe at the time. As the original 9 Knights Templar grew old and died, thousands more joined the order, and they became a very effective fighting force, the shock troops that would lead out ahead of the Crusaders. Take one example, the Battle of Montgisard, 1177. Saladin was marching toward Jerusalem with a force of upwards of 20,000 Saracens. Saladin captured several small towns and thought he could march right into Jerusalem. But before he makes it, he's met on the plains of Montgisard, nobody knows exactly where that is, by 80 knights, who are the advance force ahead of 2,000 or so infantry. The Knights Templar panic the Saracen army, the infantry comes in, and 2,000 Christians are able to rout 20,000 Saracens. And so, of course, the ranks and wealth and reputation of the Knights Templar goes up accordingly. And the Knights Templar capitalized on that reputation in battle by adopting a characteristic pattern of white cloak with a red cross on its front. They wore those colors into battle every time, so the enemies would know they were facing the Knights Templar. They weren't going to get cowardly, undisciplined knights who turned and ran from the battle every time it got heated. No, these were the original dead-enders. They would fight to the death, and of course that had a powerful psychological effect on their enemies. And even though fighting was their primary mission, most of the Templars were not combatants. For every knight that fought in battle, there were probably about 10 support staff. So at the peak of their power and influence, there were 15 to 20,000 Templars, with only 1 or 2,000 of those being combatants. You get an idea for how expensive and how much support staff every single knight required. Now, as a little aside here, if you didn't come into the Templars as a knight, they did not knight you. There was no formal knighting ceremony within the Knights Templar. You joined as a knight and stayed a knight, or you never became a knight. There were actually 3 ranks within the Templar orders. One was the noble knights, the nobility, those who came in as knights. After that, there were the non-noble sergeants. Finally, there were the chaplains. Each fighting knight functioned as a piece of heavy cavalry with 3 or 4 war horses. That's right, they would choose from among their 3 or 4 war horses. So you get an idea how expensive it was to be a knight. They also had 2 or 3 squires for each knight. So they sat atop the ranks of the Knights Templar. Below them were the non-nobility, the non-noble sergeants. The sergeants were people like builders, blacksmiths, people with essential skills and trades, who were not part of the nobility. These sergeants did not wear the white tunic with the Red Cross. They wore black or brown, but again, with the Red Cross. And then finally, there were the priests. These were ordained Catholic priests who cared for all the knights' spiritual needs. And all of these three ranks, the noble knights, the non-noble sergeants, and the priests, were subject to the authority of the Grand Master. The Grand Master was appointed for life, and he oversaw both the military dealings in the East and the financial empire that the Templars controlled in the West, and we'll talk about that. Because the Templars didn't just get rich by their donations and the patronage they received. They were also very wealthy because they were some of the first international bankers. In fact, if you had a Jeopardy question asking what was the first multinational corporation, one answer might be, who were the Knights Templar? Because they were ingenious in the ways that they could make money. We already said that they had the privilege of going everywhere within Christendom they wanted to without paying taxes. So say you're a wealthy nobleman in England. You want to go on crusade, so you find the local Knights Templar. They come and make an accounting of your estate. They watch over your estate for you while you're on crusade, of course, for a fee. But they also give you a paper with the value of your assets, and you can bring that with you, and anywhere you find Knights Templar along your journey, you can present that paper and withdraw from them against the value of your estate. So you didn't have to bring your own precious commodities with you on your pilgrimage. You didn't have to bring gold and money, which could be stolen. You just go to the Knights Templar. They were the bank. So it's easy to see how wealthy they could become by managing estates, providing banking services, and also just through the donations they receive. So you have all this money coming in. Everybody working for you has taken a vow of poverty, so you don't have to pay them very much. It's easy to see how wealthy the Order of the Knights Templar became. And with this wealth, they set up a small empire. They acquired huge tracts of land in Europe and the Middle East. They bought farms and vineyards, had their own fleet of ships, both for trade and for war, set up import-export businesses, protection rackets. Well, they wouldn't have called them rackets. They went into manufacturing various lines of Templar goods. So just like I guess there's Shaker furniture now, there were Templar goods in those days. They also constructed massive cathedrals, buildings they called commanderies and fortresses throughout Europe, Cyprus, the Middle East. So a very visible, wealthy, and active group at their height. As long as the Christians were winning in the Crusades, holding the Holy Land, the Templars were riding high. Remember, they were formed in 1120, and during the mid part of that 12th century was the height of their influence and power. But that didn't even last one century. As the Saracens became more successful in battle, as the fortune of the Crusaders turned, so did the fortunes of the Knights Templar. Most historians peg the exact battle where everything went south for the Crusaders to the Battle of Hattin in 1187. This battle was fought near the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, and in this battle, Saladin and his army of between 20 and 40,000 men almost wiped out completely a Crusader army of about 20,000 men. This was a slaughter battle. 15,000 infantry, 1,000, more than 1,000 knights, 3,000 men-at-arms, all destroyed by Saladin's army. And while Saladin spared many of the nobility and ransomed them, he spared none of the Knights Templar. All of them were executed on his orders. According to Saladin's personal secretary, Imad ed-Din, quote, Saladin ordered that they should be beheaded, choosing to have them dead rather than in prison. With him was a whole band of scholars and Sufis, and a certain number of devout men and ascetics. Each begged to be allowed to kill one of them, and drew his sword and rolled back his sleeve. Saladin, his face joyful, was sitting upon his dais. The unbelievers showed black despair. End quote. So you can imagine this horrific scene. There is Saladin, his scholars and Sufis, all of them very excited to kill his own Templar, rolling up his sleeves, picking up the sword, and Saladin watching the whole thing in glee on his dais. And remember, this is not Christian Crusader propaganda. This was written by the secretary of Saladin himself. Very festive atmosphere at the slaughter of the Knights Templar. And I think that gives you some idea of what hated and feared rivals in battle the Knights Templar were. And of course, we can't kid ourselves to think that this kind of schadenfreude, this kind of glee at the death of the enemy was unique to the Saracens. There were plenty of atrocities on both sides, and by many accounts, the Crusaders could be even worse. Now, as always happens when you begin to lose, people start pointing fingers, and there's plenty of blame to go around. The barons blamed the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar blamed the Knights Hospitaller. The Knights Hospitaller blamed the Teutonic Knights. And everybody squabbled with everyone else. And as a consequence, the Knights Templar no longer enjoyed universal approbation. And in fact, separate factions would go off to war and claim victory without involving the other factions. As a consequence, the Knights Templar began to be left out of some key battles during the later Crusades. And remember, the headquarters for the Knights Templar were in Jerusalem. When Jerusalem was lost to the Saracens, they lost their headquarters. They began to lose a little prestige, a little of their mystique. In fact, during some of the later battles of the Crusade, they were left out altogether. In 1229, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, reclaims the city of Jerusalem for the Christians. The Knights Templar were not even involved in those battles. And they only held the city. The Christians only held Jerusalem until 1244, just a little over a decade, until the Saracens recaptured it. And Jerusalem wouldn't return to Western control until 1917, almost 700 years later, when the British captured it from the Ottoman Empire. So the Templars, displaced, had to relocate their headquarters. In 1187, after the Battle of Hattin, they had to move their headquarters north to Acre. They held Acre for almost 100 years until 1291. Then they began a series of displacements farther and farther north. Seemingly every year they had to move again until they ended up on the island of Cyprus. And by 1302 or 1303, they lost even the island of Cyprus. That was the last foothold of any crusaders in anything close to the Holy Land. The last Templars left the island of Cyprus in 1303. So, of course, predictably, during this entire time, Europe was losing interest in the Crusades. And it wasn't just that they were losing battles in the Holy Land one after another. It was also the fact that the Mongols presented a greater existential threat to Western Christendom. So as Western Christendom lost interest in the Crusades, it lost interest in the Templars. And this is the very precarious position that the Knights Templar found themselves in the early part of the 14th century. They had businesses and interests, farms and vineyards, dotting Europe. They still didn't have to answer or pay taxes to kings or secular rulers anywhere in Europe. And yet they no longer had the prestige or commanded the fear or fighting respect they once had. So this is a dangerous mismatch. This is a formula for resentment. When you have a lot more wealth and entitlement than you have power and prestige, it won't be long before somebody exploits that mismatch. And that's exactly what a powerful king in France did. In 1305, one of the expelled members of the Knights Templar brought a series of accusations to the French king, Philip IV, also known as Philip the Fair. And he accused the Knights Templar and their Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, of a whole series of pagan, occult, unnatural, mystical practices that were an offense in the eyes of the church. Now, whether Philip the Fair believe these charges or not is a matter of historical debate. But it was very convenient for him to believe these charges for a couple of reasons. One is he was in debt from fighting a series of wars. Some of that debt was owed to the Knights Templar. So any way to get out of paying that debt would greatly assist his cause. Along with that, within the country of Philip IV, Philip the Fair, France in other words, the Knights Templar had a series of very valuable holdings. If Philip could confiscate those holdings and the treasures of the Knights Templar, he'd have a huge source of revenue. What made the Templars' predicament even more dangerous is the fact that at the time, the seat of the papacy had been moved to France into the realm of Philip IV. So Clement V was currently residing in Avignon. So Clement V, the Pope, was in a precarious situation. He asked Jacques de Molay to come and meet with him, asked him to come discuss the charges that had been leveled against him and the Knights Templar. At this meeting, it's generally agreed that Clement V thought that all of the charges against the Knights Templar were bunk, and we'll detail those charges in just a moment. But Clement was under tremendous pressure from Philip IV, who demanded that the Pope take action against the Knights Templar. This brings us to one of the most famous Friday the 13th in history. In fact, this date is so infamous that many people believe that the entire superstition around Friday the 13th began Friday the 13th, 1307, in France. And while that's probably not true, Friday the 13th, 1307, indeed was a day of infamy in France. That's the day that King Philip IV ordered Jacques de Molay and scores all of the French Templars arrested simultaneously. Remember, Philip wanted to confiscate the wealth of the Templars. And if they heard that their leadership was being arrested, they could have packed up their wealth and escaped from the country. So he sent out secret written letters to the local authorities, commanding them to arrest the Knights Templar in their provinces at a certain time on Friday the 13th, 1307. And that's exactly what happened. On this same order was the arrest warrant. And on the arrest warrant was a whole catalog of charges, ranging, in my opinion, from the ridiculous to the absurd to the obscene. And yet I've heard many historians claim that there might have been some validity to some of the charges. I don't claim to know whether or not that's true. But let me read to you some of the charges on the arrest warrant. It began with the words, quote, "God is not pleased. We have enemies of the faith in the kingdom," end quote. Claims were made that during the initiation ceremonies of the Knights Templar, they always had an elaborate and formal initiation ceremony for their new recruits. During these ceremonies, it was alleged, recruits were forced to spit on the cross, deny Christ, and, quote, engage in indecent kissing, end quote. And since this was an all-male order, you can understand that indecent kissing meant that men were kissing men. At the time, it was generally agreed that all of these charges were politicized. There was no real evidence that any of this was taking place. But of course, in these days of witch burnings and other atrocities, all you needed were charges, and then you could begin to torture confessions out of people. And of course, under torture, people would confess to anything. And even though everyone knew these confessions were obtained under duress, they would cause a national scandal, outrage among the populace. Templars were charged with and confessed to corruption, fraud, secrecy, plotting against the king, sedition, anti-Christian behavior such as spitting on the cross or denying the Christ. And as soon as these confessions were obtained, they were publicized, all in an attempt to put pressure, public pressure, on Pope Clement V to end the special protections that the knights had enjoyed. And you can actually read some of these confessions. One says, quote, "I, Raymond de la Fere, 21 years old, admit that I have spat 3 times on the cross, but only from my mouth and not from my heart," end quote. One of the accusations that came up again and again was that of idolatry. It was said that the Templars had a severed head with 2 faces, or a severed head with 3 faces, or a severed head with the face of a cat and the face of a human. This accusation came up so many times that there might be a kernel of truth to it. Wouldn't even be all that surprising, because relics were all the rage in Christian Europe at that time. If they had what they considered a sacred head, then of course they would venerate it. Shrunken head with 2 faces is certainly just as striking as the finger bone of St. Peter or the earlobe of one of the thieves on the cross. Another accusation that came up again and again is that the Knights Templar worshipped a figure known as Baphomet, B-A-P-H-O-M-E-T. This has led most historians to speculate that Baphomet, this mysterious idol that the Knights Templar were supposedly worshipping, might also have a kernel of historical truth. In fact, the name Baphomet showed up in poetry in the Middle Ages as another name for Mohammed. Now, why would that be significant? According to histories, the Knights Templar did not always have an adversarial relationship with the Muslims in the Holy Land. At times, in fact, that relationship was very good, and the Knights Templar would engage in trade or discourse with the Muslims in the Holy Land, the Saracens. So, of course, it's possible that some of the respect the Saracens had for Muhammad could have rubbed off or found its way into the lore of the Knights Templar. But what seems very unlikely, impossible in fact, is that they would have had an idol of Muhammad. No Saracen would have an idol of anything, and no Christian would have an idol of Muhammad. So that seems unlikely. But it's certainly possible that some of the teachings or words of Muhammad made their way into Knights Templar lore. And that might explain some of this Baphomet talk. No one really knows. No one knows what this Baphomet was that the Knights Templar were accused of worshipping. Anyway, the accusations were flying fast and furious, the confessions were coming, according to the torture, and public sentiment was aroused against the Knights Templar. This put a lot of pressure on Clement V, and in response, Clement did what any pragmatic leader would do, and that is totally cave and sell out your own loyal subjects. On 22 November 1307, Pope Clement sends out a papal bull instructing all Christian monarchs in Europe to arrest all Knights Templar and seize all their assets. Now, in Clement's defense, he did try to protect the lives of the Knights Templar. The way that he did that was by demanding that all of the cases against the Knights Templar be heard by him, by the Pope himself, undoubtedly feeling that they would get a more fair hearing in front of him then in front of the same monarchs who are trying to seize all their assets. This had the effect of ending the secular torture and imprisonment of the Knights Templar. And as soon as they were free from torture, they recanted everything. They said, "We confessed only because we were being tortured. None of it was true. It's all nonsense. We're totally innocent." Well, Philip IV couldn't stand for this. So in 1310, before the Pope could set up his own trial for the Knights Templar, Philip IV took some of their forced confessions and said, "I don't need any more evidence than this." And he burned dozens of Knights Templar at the stake in 1310. Well, as you can imagine, this offended Pope Clement. But Philip IV threatened military action against him if he didn't acquiesce to his demands. Clement was left essentially with no options. He had no chance to set up his own trial for the Knights Templar. He had to totally disband the order. The reason that he gave, though, is telling. He said, "Because there has been a public outcry and scandal generated by the confessions of the Knights Templar, I have no choice but to disband the order." He never said that they were guilty of the crimes they'd been accused of. Now, all this time, Jacques de Molay had been arrested and biding his time in prison. And I want to talk about his case in depth because we have the most information about it and because it's representative of what happened to so many of the Knights Templar at that time. So remember, he's arrested on Friday the 13th of October, 1307. He was being held under accusation of five very specific charges. The first was renunciation of and spitting on the cross during the initiation ceremonies that he presided over. So clearly a capital offense. The second charge was even more scandalous. That is that as a new initiate was brought in, the initiate would be stripped and kissed three times by the preceptor, once on the belly button, once on his butt, and once on his mouth, again as Jacques de Molay presided. I'm not sure what the significance of these three locations was. Let's move on to the third accusation. The third accusation is that as every novice was brought into the order, he was told that, quote, "unnatural lust was natural and to be engaged in frequently," end quote. The fourth charge was that as every initiate was brought into the order, he was given a cord to wrap around his waist. This cord was consecrated because it was wrapped around the head of an idol with a great big beard. Now, this might have been Baphomet or it might have been the human head with two or three faces. We just don't know. But Jacques de Molay was presiding over initiation where the cord was made sacred by wrapping it around the head of an idol. And finally, this is the fifth charge. The priests of the Order of the Knights Templar did not consecrate the host when they celebrated the Mass. Of course, Jacques denied all of these charges until he was tortured, and then he was only human after all. And with very few exceptions, anyone who is being tortured long enough will confess to anything. De Molay was arrested on the 13th of October, and by the 24th of October, he had signed a confession to all of the above accusations. But King Philip, Philip the Fair, and his torturers were not done with Jacques de Molay yet. They demanded that he write up a letter to be sent to all Templars that they also should confess to all of the above, all of the five accusations we just listed. And predictably, under torture, that's exactly what Jacques de Molay does. He signs the letter and it's sent out to all of the Templars. Now, there's a common misconception we have about people in the medieval times, that they were actually dumb enough to believe the things that people confess to under torture. The truth is, they knew as well as we know now that people would confess to anything under torture. They simply chose to ignore it a lot of the time. Pope Clement knows that this was a confession extracted under torture. He doesn't believe a word of it. And Clement recognizes another ingredient here. And that is that Philip IV, the same king, had been angry with a dead pope, Boniface VIII, Clement V's predecessor. And he demanded that Clement V put the previous pope on trial posthumously with these exact same sets of charges. Whenever Philip the Fair didn't like somebody, he put them on trial, and these seemed to be the charges he preferred. So Clement V had a difficult dilemma before him, and I say that tongue-in-cheek. Either Pope Boniface VIII and Jacques de Molay committed the exact same heretical acts, or heaven forbid, Philip IV was kind of stupid and unoriginal, kind of a one-trick pony, and he was too lazy to even think of five new charges to accuse Jacques de Molay of. So he used the exact same charges he had previously leveled against Boniface VIII. So Clement knew exactly what was going on, but he was in a position of vulnerability. So he did something very smart. He dispatched two cardinals to Paris to hear Molay's side of the story, this time without torture involved. And just as predictably, Molay retracted his confession in toto. None of the things he was accused of actually occurred. This was December of 1307, and over the next several months, a power struggle ensued between the king and the pope about the fate of the Knights Templar. By August of 1308, they resolved this power struggle by deciding that the pope himself would try the dignitaries of the Knights Templar, including Molay, whereas the lesser members of the order would be tried by the Kingdom of France. Philip didn't waste much time burning all the Templars he could. He used their forced confessions from years before to burn 54 of them at the stake between the 10th and 12th of May in 1310. And on the 22nd of March 1312, the Pope agreed to abolish the Order of the Knights Templar. So despite all the suspicions and conspiracy theories the Knights Templar inspired throughout history after the fact, the truth is the Order only existed formally for 192 years. From 1120 to 1312. As far as the fate of Jacques de Molay, that's a little more confusing. He was probably between 70 and 75 in the year 1314. His fate was determined by a body of three cardinals who heard his earlier confessions and, of course, his earlier retractions, and then the fact that he seemed to confess again once more under pressure from the Kingdom of France. They heard all of this and they decided that perpetual imprisonment was the right sentence for Jacques de Molay. So March 19, 1314, a commission of three cardinals condemns de Molay and other dignitaries from the Templar order to perpetual imprisonment for the rest of their lives. As soon as de Molay heard that sentence, he strenuously objected. He shouted that he was innocent and retracted all of his previous confessions. De Molay was condemned as a relapsed heretic and burned that same day. Now, why would that happen? I think, and I don't know this, but I believe that Molay must have violated some kind of conditions he had set up with the Council of Three Cardinals. If he would accept responsibility for some of his crimes, his alleged crimes, then the cardinals would show mercy on him. He might have been surprised by the lifetime imprisonment sentence that they thought was merciful and burst out that he was innocent and in so doing condemned himself to the flames. It also seems possible that Philip was putting tremendous pressure on these cardinals to find de Molay guilty and burn him. And in the end, they did exactly what the king wanted. According to the historian Henry Charles Lee, this is what happened, quote, "The cardinals dallied with their duty until the 18th of March 1314, when, on a scaffold in front of Notre Dame, Jacques de Molay, Templar Grand Master, and they list some others, were brought forth from the jail in which they had for nearly 7 years lain, to receive the sentence agreed upon by the cardinals in conjunction with the archbishop and some other prelates who they had called in. Considering the offenses to which the culprits had confessed and confirmed, the penance imposed was in accordance with the rule, that of perpetual imprisonment. The affair was supposed to be concluded." So in other words, de Molay and other prisoners are brought out. They had already confessed and confirmed their confession and were simply supposed to plead guilty and they would be sentenced to perpetual imprisonment and the whole affair would be over. I'll go on with Lee's writings. He says, quote, "The affair was supposed to be concluded when, to the dismay of the prelates and wonderment of the assembled crowd, Jacques de Molay arose. They had been guilty, they said, not of the crimes imputed to them, but of basely betraying their order to save their own lives. The Knights Templar was pure and holy, the charges were fictitious, and the confessions false." Cardinals really didn't know what to do at that point. This was not going according to plan. Everything was supposed to work smoothly. They would confess, they would be sentenced to life in prison, everybody would go home happy, and the Knights Templar would not be burned at the stake. But in the end, de Molay just couldn't do it. He couldn't stand to see the name of the Knights Templar sullied in that way. So he said, "It was all bunk, this was a fake trial, a forced confession, I'm innocent." Well, you can guess how Philip IV reacted when he got news of this. He took a few minutes to pronounce Jacques de Molay a relapsed heretic who had suffered death by fire. There's a small island in the Seine next to the much larger island on which Notre Dame Cathedral stands, and there on that small island, within sight of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, a pyre was built, and Jacques de Molay that same evening was slowly burned to death. He and those burned with him refused all offers of pardon. They utterly refused to retract the recantation of their previous confession. I know that's pretty convoluted. But in other words, they refused to say that they were guilty, and they were slowly and torturously burned to death. Jacques de Molay's only request, according to people who witnessed the event, was that he be left not blindfolded so that he could watch the Notre Dame Cathedral as he burned. The cathedral, by the way, that he and his order had helped with the building of. As the crowd watched him die, they were moved by the composure with which he suffered the indescribable agony of being slowly burned to death. In fact, his composure was so great that there was immediate talk of him being a martyr. People watching him being burned actually rushed to the site to collect his ashes as holy relics. And there's an apocryphal story that is at least in part based on fact, that as Molay was burning from his pyre, he cursed Philip IV and his descendants, and possibly anyone who had something to do with his unfair death. And this might be, like I said, true in part, as Molay might have said something to that effect, and others of the Templars being burned at the same time may have also promised that God would avenge their deaths. Whatever the case might be, Philip and Clement, Pope and King, were both dead within a year and a day of these events. Clement V was dead within a month and a week. He succumbed to a long illness on the 20th of April, 1314. Philip himself died of a stroke while hunting about a year after this. And between 1314 and 1328, three sons and a grandson of Philip the Fair had all died, and his house and family, which had ruled France for over 300 years by this time, collapsed within a single generation. There's a little more to the story also, historically speaking. In the year 2001, a paleographer with access to the Vatican secret archives named Barbara Fraile, F-R-A-L-E, found an ancient parchment in the Vatican secret archives from 1308, which explicitly confirmed that in 1308, Pope Clement V absolved Jacques de Molay and other leaders of the Knights Templar order. So just a year after his arrest and imprisonment and trial, and about 6 years before he would be eventually burned at the stake, Jacques de Molay was formally absolved by the Pope, which meant, in other words, that he was restored to all of his sacraments and into unity and fellowship with the Church. In other words, his soul was saved. Now, we might look back on that as small consolation. You know, Clement's absolution plus a cell phone will get you a phone call. But to Jacques de Molay, that would have meant everything. He was pious and devout and would have been concerned for the welfare of his soul. So he would have cherished that absolution. And it makes it clear also that Clement V didn't agree with what was being done to the Knights Templar. So we have to assume his hands were somewhat tied. I'm not saying that excuses all of his actions in this case, but at least he's not a monster with no conscience. In fact, on his deathbed, he's said to have wept tears of remorse over what was done to the Knights Templar, among a few other outrages he was involved in. And so that's the story of the Knights Templar. Everything that can be known about the Knights Templar. Did many of them escape with a fabulous treasure which has not been found to this very day? Did they have possession of the lost Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail? Did they recapture Jerusalem with Mongol invaders sometime in the 1300s? Do they continue to exert influence over kings and presidents? Were they original founders of the Masonic rituals? Truth is, none of that seems very likely. But then again, remember, you can't prove they weren't involved in all of those things. So there you go. I've officially joined the ranks of lunatic, according to the earlier quotes from Umberto Eco. This concludes this episode of the History of Being Human podcast. I'm the host, Noel Armstrong. Feel free to email me at thobhpodcast@gmail.com.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.